As we begin this period of our retreat time, I think it's important to pay attention to the foundations and basis of our of meditation or meditation practice. And the other day I spoke, of course, about the establishing of mindfulness, and in terms of the meditation and the meditation practice, the attention to freeing the mind from the hindrances is very, it's essential. Cultivation of any meditation requires that we are able to pull the mind back from its habit of getting bound up with those obstructions and hindrances. I mean, they're well named. These hinder the development of the wholesome qualities of mind. They hinder the ability of the mind to see clearly. They hinder the mind in its ability to understand things in their true nature. So that as long as those hindrances are functioning, we're at a kind of an impossible disadvantage. If one thinks of the anthropomorphizing of Mara, as long as we're under the sway of the hindrances, then we are definitely under the sway of Mara. Mara has easy control, easy access, and we're kind of another shill for Mara's army. Being attentive to these, bringing these hindrances into abeyance. The image that, or one of the images, the Buddha of course uses many images, but one of the images that the Buddha uses with the hindrances is the gold. Whenever gold is mixed with different other metals. Buddha gives sort of five metals: iron, lead, silver, tin, copper. And whenever those are mixed with gold, then the gold is neither kind of lustrous nor malleable. And he said, in the same way, when the mind is overwhelmed by the five hindrances, sense, desire, ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness, worry, and skeptical doubt, then the mind is neither lustrous nor malleable either. The mind is brittle and stiff and unable to be worked into something worthy of jewelry or something valuable. So that and of course the opposite is true when the when those hindrances are freed, then the mind is able to shine forth. It's able to be malleable. It's able to take on its too true kind of beauty. So being attentive to these hindrances and learning how to work with them. One is just learning how to identify them. You know, as we're sitting in meditation, it's not just a matter of breathing in, breathing out, breathing in, breathing out. Then all of a sudden the hindrances are magically disappear from the mind. One has to be able to identify what is the hindrance. Is the hindrance present? What is it that allows the particular hindrance to arise? What do I do to free the mind from a particular hindrance? Using the act of establishing mindfulness as a means of seeing more clearly what the hindrance is, but then also experimenting with different techniques, different methods, different skillful means to be able to free the mind from any particular hindrance. That sense of one really identifying clearly what a hindrance is and what's a suitable kind of remedy. With sensual desire, the Buddha oftentimes encourages contemplation of the unattractive of the 32 parts of the body, ill will. The Buddha oftentimes recommends cultivation of loving kindness, but one actually has to say identify clearly within oneself. One, what the particular hindrance is, and two, what is a suitable means of countering the particular hindrance, and of course that development of mindfulness is also being able to have a clear recognition of what one is experiencing, and how to counter it, and do the actual attempts and efforts that one makes. Is it actually having an effect? What comes to mind I remember one monk that he wasn't in our tradition, but he was somebody that we knew, and over the years, you know, watching him develop his skillful means, and he was sort of putting, in an idealized fashion, assuming as a monastic one, and a celibate monastic, then one needed to be cultivating the 32 parts of the body, death contemplations, and I was going on a really regular basis to autopsies, and his room sort of filled with pictures of corpses and body parts, but in reality, what it was doing was just sort of making him more depressed and aversive than he already was. And So that you know, not really having a clear recognition of what the actual hindrance was, and then what was a workable tool to deal with it. So that actually identifying what are the hindrances that I'm experiencing, what are the blocks to the meditation, because sometimes there is sort of an idealized version in one's mind of what one should be doing, what the practice should be about, and not actually paying attention to what is the experience, what happens when one sits in a meditation posture and tries to establish mindfulness on the breath as it comes in, mindfulness on the breath as it goes out. What's happening? Is what is happening, is it wholesome or unwholesome? Is it beneficial? Is it not beneficial? Is it leading to the increase of wholesome mental states and the decrease of the unwholesome? Or what is happening? So to be attentive to the content of the mind and the degree of clarity, of peace, of understanding that is being fostered or not. And again, these five hindrances are a good way of gauging or trying to recognize more clearly what's actually happening. It depends on one's own self-perception as well. I can remember for myself this sort of thinking, starting meditation and say, oh, there's five hindrances, okay, I've got to take a look. And then sort of like, my gosh, I've got every hindrance. Every hindrance is here all the time. It's this or this. And the self-perception of being totally awash in all the hindrances simultaneously, and it's not actually possible. the reality of how mental states actually work, you're only experiencing one sort of thought at a time, but the feeling is of course of being swept up by all these hindrances, so that starting to parse out the experience of the mind, starting to understand more clearly what is it that I'm experiencing, and how to work skillfully with that. And that's why a meditation object is actually so important. It's an idealized version of how the mind would be if we were really wise and clear, that we would just be able to establish ourselves in an open and discerning awareness, and just be able to see clearly. But that isn't usually how most of us actually experience ourselves or the world. So that a meditation object is a means by which we can start to pick up the task, they pick up the task of applying attention, so that is paying attention to the in-breath and the breath as it comes in, starting to really note what are the sensations, what's the beginning of the in-breath like, what is the, as the breath comes in, what is the experience of that? As we come to the end of the in-breath, what is the experience of that? What's it like? What is there? And there's the experience of the out-breath, the beginning of the out-breath, the sensation of that, the texture of it, the how it forms in one's mind. And what that does is provide provides a mirror of that reflects back the way that the mind moves or wobbles or proliferates or drifts into dullness or seeks for some kind of object of attraction or aversion or some doubt or worry. And then because you're attending to an object and trying to clarify that object, then it shines back onto the mind of what the mind is doing. What's the actual state of the mind? What is the quality of the mental state itself? So that this simple exercise of paying attention to one in-breath and one out-breath gives us an opportunity to really understand more clearly what are the obstructions that arise, what are the ways that they, when the mind becomes more clear, what do we experience? What's the actual feeling tone? What's the experience of mindfulness and clarity? What are the obstructions to mindfulness and clarity? What does it feel like when there's a sense of well-being and ease? And how does the mind then sort of, from a place of well-being and ease, how do we lose that? Where does it get lost? What does the mind actually, what are the associations in the mind that cause it to drift and lose its center and focus? So that the, just that, establishing the anchor of attention and awareness on an in-breath and an out-breath, one's giving oneself the opportunity to really experience so much more clearly how do we work with this mind, so that that developing of is kind of a frame of reference of these hindrances, and recognizing how do those hindrances arise, how do they, what's their nutriment, what do they feed on? And so what does sensual desire feed on? What's it seeking? What's it trying to gain? What does anger and ill will? What's it feeding on? How does it grow strong and healthy? And the same with the other hindrances. And I think that really paying attention to that sense of the feeding of a hindrance, Because like sensual desire, it feeds on that kind of interest and delight in something pleasurable. It's feeding on its nutriment is it's that kind of interest and delight in something pleasurable. Stimulating, exciting in some way. And so then the sensual desire is nourished and gets strong and healthy. So that learning how to counter that or learning how to just withholding the nutriment of it. Remember Ajahn Chah sort of saying with the, it's just like you get like cats coming around and it'll especially in not so much in forest monasteries, in village monasteries, people let their cats go and then these cats, well, cats and dogs, the monasteries often just fill up with cats and dogs and if you keep feeding them they're there all the time, breeding all their, not only the original ones are there, and so all their offspring, so that it the monasteries end up getting cluttered with these stray cats and dogs, and just by not feeding them. Then they just go somewhere else, and they don't stay. So in the same with the hindrances of the mind, one is just not feeding them. One is recognizing more clearly what is the nutriment, what's the sustenance of these hindrances, so that they. Like ill will, we feed ill will with the sense of, kind of indignation or the sense of feeling wronged or the sense of this is not right, it shouldn't be this way, or not getting what we want, so that when we don't get what we want, then there's kind of ill will and aversion, but all of these kind of mental states are being fed by that fundamental stance underneath it. I need to get what I want. It should be my way, or it shouldn't be that way, whatever that way is, the kind of indignation, self-righteousness, that it feeds that anger and that ill will. So that recognizing how to not feed it, the kind of the sloth and torpor. When we acquiesce to that kind of dullness, drifting, which is somewhat pleasant in a dull, dreary way. there's that amorphous, drifty kind of state of mind, or just sort of sinking into the pleasure of being kind of full after the meal, and then sort of the mind drifts with that, when there is a feeling of tiredness, the attention is drawn to the kind of the tiredness, or the oh woe is me, I am tired, And then the natural response is, well, just sort of zone out and it isn't, you know, rationally thought through, but it's that kind of acquiescing and giving attention to that kind of lack of clarity, drifting, dull states of mind. Similarly, with restlessness and worry, that feeding the feeding of the hindrance is you know when there is that there is a kind of maybe like a feeling of uncertainty. It's uncertain. Yeah, what's going to happen? And of course, the reality is we don't have a clue what's going to happen. but the mind it obsesses. It gives attention to it. It focuses on that. And then there's that sense of. That restlessness, because it's uncertain, it's unsure. And this is exactly why Ajahn Chah makes a point of taking that as a focal point for attention. Yeah, this is not a sure thing, it's uncertain. Not to sort of spin you off into restlessness and worry and kind of wavering and doubt, but just to be able to say, oh, this is uncertain, but I can be mindful of this, rather than proliferate from that point and then feed that agitation within the mind, the wavering in the mind. So coming to a place of where one is able to hold on uncertainty and not be feeling obligated to respond with a kind of anxiety. Always illustrated well by that vignette from Winnie the Pooh, where the piglet and Pooh are walking through the forest, and it's a storm is coming up, and the wind is blowing, and kind of leaves and branches are kind of falling down. It's a bit disconcerting, but it's just what storms do. But of course, Piglet is a bit of an anxiety type. What do we do? What would happen if a branch falls down and hits us? And Pooh thought about that for a while. So, what if it didn't? And that, which but it hasn't actually happened yet. It may or may not happen. Why don't we work on the assumption that it doesn't? So not feeding that restlessness and worry. We can still be mind doesn't mean we have to be complacent or dull. It's just this, but not feeding those sources of restlessness, of wavering, of doubt, of worry. Those are things that we. It isn't as if we're kind of, Because, I mean, there is an idiom of in meditation circles of sort of being attacked by the hindrances. And, you know, and it's not that we're attacked by the hindrances. If some external thing comes in and sneaks up from behind, it's that we actually feed and nourish and nurture the hindrances within us, and to be able to be proactive in undermining and relinquishing and bringing up an alternative, an alternative to sense desire. Is contentment an alternative to ill will? Is loving kindness an alternative to sloth and torpor? Is kind of energy and brightness an alternative to restlessness and worry? Is a sense of confidence and faith. Restlessness an alternative to skeptical doubt is steadiness and stability. So that to be able to feed and nourish what is an alternative, rather than just feeding the hindrances, throwing a bone to the random obstructions in the mind. So in meditation, the anchor is our meditation object, but it's not just that if you force the mind on the meditation object long enough, then the hindrances are all going to go away. So we have to use discernment and skill in both understanding those hindrances, what they're fed with, what they're nourished with, and what is an alternative, what is a wise and skillful response to those hindrances. So there's something to work with in the practice.